Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
Dun dun dun. This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I'm here with my extremely long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork. We're also here with Emma Scramita, a writer, an editor, a makeup artist, a creative force in Winnipeg, who is going to share some of her time with us. And we're going to talk about process and artistic expression in lots of different media. Welcome, Emma.
Amazing. Thanks for having me. Super excited.
So you, among many things, are a editor and director of a company, Mythos & Inc., that is a publisher that produces content for others. You write for yourself. You do crazy makeup effects for yourself. How does this work? This is really what it comes
down to. It's a lot of hats.
It's a lot of hats. Yeah, I have a very full day planner that I need to use religiously in order to keep track of all of my stuff. One thing I do always find with wearing a lot of creative hats is I always feel whenever I'm doing one creative thing, I'm robbing some other creative thing. Like if I'm doing makeup, I'm like, oh, I should be writing. Or if I'm writing, I'm like, oh, I should be working on makeup stuff. It's difficult to balance a lot of passions at the same time, which I'm sure you guys have also experienced. But
yeah, but it's funny as you say that you're robbing from it. That's the first time I've ever thought about it in that way. And I suddenly have some guilt and anxiety that I didn't have before.
I try to think of it like if I'm rather than robbing, I'm recharging the batteries for that. Like if I'm
sending, that's how I think of it.
Right? Yeah, like that's a better way to think of it. Sure.
You need to recharge those batteries. You can't be doing that one thing all the time. So spending some time away from it is going to, you're going to come back stronger when you do come back to it.
Totally.
As long as you don't leave it for too long. Don't let it go stagnant, but spending some time outside with the family or, you know, going for a run or going to the gym, I think you come back better than if you just work through that time instead.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
So writing, I mean, understand is too full of a word, but I understand the process of writing. I understand more or less the process of
publishing. You get writing someday.
Someday. I'll get it someday. But what I don't understand is how you can turn a regular human face into a crazy vampire with gigantic ears. And like, you know, I've been on set on small films. I've worked in some horror stuff. So I see it and I understand how to ask for it, but I don't know how it's done.
Mm.
Do you mind going into the like deep tissue of making this stuff?
Yeah, I would love to. There's many different ways of making monsters with makeup. So one way, if you were doing a burned vampire, which is something I've done before, is one of the techniques or mediums I really like to use is gelatin prosthetics. Gelatin, basically the same stuff that you just get at the grocery store, is fantastic to use for prosthetics because it's cheap. It's reusable, meaning that you can always melt it down and use it again, which is great for when you're starting out because it's not as expensive as something like silicone, which you can only use once. So if you mess up, it's gone forever and then you're screwed. And you can get some really cool effects with gelatin. So for something like a prosthetic made of gelatin, you would start by sculpting whatever you want your prosthetic to look like. So if you're making a wound or a nose or a weird thing to stick on your face, you would sculpt it out of clay. You would cast it using either silicone or plaster of Paris. Again, plaster of Paris is less expensive, so it's nice to work with if you're a beginner. And then you would fill it with gelatin and you would make a little prosthetic out of it, which you would then glue to your face and you would paint with alcohol paints or cream paints or makeup cosmetic ones, not just regular paint from the store, but and make it blend in and look really cool. And you can also use gelatin for sort of dripping on things. So if you're doing like a burn or a weird vampire skin texture, which I've used it for before, you kind of just like drizzle it all over your face and makes a really gross, burned, melty skin look, which is super fun.
It's interesting to hear you talk about making a three-dimensional prosthetic, like adhered prosthetic, the same way that Justin might draw the same robot twice. Right? Like, oh, I can draw that again. Like, you keep referring to, like, this burned vampire. Like, oh, I can do it. I can make you a burned vampire, no problem. And, you know, working in 2D with a little bit of muscle memory, I can draw the same drawing pretty close over and over. I don't know how it is, but dear listeners, yes, there is a cat, but it's not in our room.
My cat is needy and he yells when he wants attention.
Right. How does one, I mean, it seems like drawing, I know how to draw a nose so that it looks like the same nose twice in two different illustrations, more or less. I mean, mileage may vary on people who have looked at my work, but I don't know how you would make the same features, sculpt the same features. It's because you're using the same mold, or do you have to do that each time anew?
You can, ideally, you can use the same mold. So usually your molds or your masters you can reuse, which is definitely a lot easier than trying to sculpt the same thing every time. The tricky bit comes in when you're doing it for different people, because obviously if you're putting a nose on somebody's nose, everybody's nose looks different. So it won't fit on my nose the same way it would on yours. So that's when you would do—
certainly not on my nose.
More that, so then it, yeah, it would look completely different, probably wouldn't fit properly. So instead you would take a cast of your face and then you would sculpt directly onto it to make a nose that would fit your nose. And then, which is fun. That's one of the tricky things about 3D that is, or makeup in specific, which is really tricky, is that you're not just working with sort of a blank piece of paper or a blank slab of clay. You also are working with actual people's faces and what their skin is like and what their features look like and how that's gonna react with their body chemistry or look on their face. So that gets a little bit tricky, but the nice thing is that once you do have that down, once you do that sculpt, you can keep reusing it. Not indefinitely, like the molds will wear down over time the more you use them, but you can use them definitely like dozens of times, especially if you're taking care of them, and just run the same prosthetics over and over again, which is how all those big movies get done, because they're, you know, using the same molds, or you can make copies of that mold. So you have multiple molds. So if you're doing, you know, a big shoot where you need 1,000 elf ears, you can just keep running the same molds over and over again to get all of those prosthetics done.
Right, or a whole bunch of hobbit feet or whatever.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How much does the performer underneath affect the actual process of application? Like, I imagine there must be some actors who, I mean, I know it from the silent film era and the beginning of talkies. I love all those old black and white horror movies. There was a few of those actors who applied their own makeups and prosthetics, because if they did it themselves, they could touch their own eye, they could move, you know, they could do all of these things that allowed them to get the best performance, right? The I'm forgetting the name of the actor now, but the man who played the original Phantom of the Opera in the first film, you know, they think he used a wire to pull his own nose up under the prosthetic attached to the back of his head. No one still knows to this day how he got that disappeared nose, because he's a real human person with a real nose in it, and it was gone, right? But he did his own makeup and his own effects. So when, you know, like if you were to turn Justin into something and he was really squeamish or like didn't like having his ears touched, what then happens?
Oh yeah, that is definitely one of the things that makes it really hard to apply things, is if people are squirmy or twitchy or, you know, have claustrophobia and don't want stuff stuck all over their faces. So ideally in those circumstances, you would work with the director to kind of minimize the amount of prosthetics or makeup that you had to apply, especially in, you know, specific areas. So if it was really like, I don't like my ears touch, I will freak out. Maybe it's like okay, maybe we don't put too much on the ears. Maybe we hide the ears as much as possible in different shots and do some sort of camera movie magic. If you really had to get something stuck to someone who didn't want it, I guess you would just have to work with them as much as possible. Really making the person in your chair feel comfortable goes a really long way. You know, explaining the process to them so they know, okay, this is going to be happening now. This is glue. This is going to go on your face. It's going to feel cold and sticky. Going through those steps usually helps people to feel a little bit more comfortable. And then, you know, using as light a hand as possible and really trying to work with the actors that they feel as comfortable as possible. There's a story speaking of hobbit feet, but in Lord of the Rings, the actor who played Gimli, John Rhys-Davies, had a really bad allergy to the prosthetics that they were using, which was horrible. It like peeled off his skin every day. So they could only shoot every like third day or something, because they would like burn off all the skin on his face. They'd have to reapply it later. That is not an ideal situation. I don't know why they didn't like use a different type of glue or prosthetic or something, but that's really what you want to avoid, is making your actors uncomfortable, especially because acting through prosthetics is already difficult enough. Like, so much of acting is facial expression, which is hard to do when you've got plastic and rubber glued to your face. So you really want your actor to feel comfortable in what they're wearing as much as possible.
I don't know half of you half as well as I should like, and I like less than half of you half as well as you deserve.
How much control do you have over the look versus, like, are you handed kind of a detailed description of exactly what they want, or do you usually have freedom to kind of do what you think will look best?
That depends on the production. I've been mostly working on kind of smaller indie projects, which usually has a little bit more creative flexibility, and the producer or the director is more open to hearing things. I'm sure in certain circumstances they probably give you, this is exactly what it has to look like, we need it to be, you know, like this, make it happen, and you just have to go with it. But it's always nice when you do have some flexibility, especially because, you know, the job of a producer or a director and the job of a makeup artist is very different. So they may not always understand what they're asking for or what's doable and what's not doable.
I can speak to this directly. When we're working on the independent feature, Agrisomnia, the actress, Mel, was in this one scene where they had decided the ghostly apparition of her arriving would have the you know, the classic black ghost eyes, right? Like blacked out contacts. On paper and in the script, this is amazing. It works great. The effects person, no problem, gets the right kind of contacts. The performer is fine to put them in. But of course, as soon as they then stand up and you try to give direction, it's like, oh, wait, no, I can't see.
Yeah.
Right? I can't see out of these, right? You guys didn't know that before, right? I'd be like, well,
so it only works if she doesn't have to move,
right? So now I don't remember exactly, but I feel like in the shot of that film, there's a dolly move where she's pushed out so that it feels like she's floating. But I honestly think that the consideration at the time was, since she can't see, we'll put her on a rig. No, we'll put her on the rig and float her so that the track is set. She doesn't have to see. She can just perform sort of pantomime.
Yeah. They cracked that, or are they still?
I'm sure it's cracked long ago. This is in the ancient times, right? Like, I did not have a cell phone at the time, for example. Like, this is how long ago that was. But it's like what you say, where the producer or the art director, in my case, that was my fault, because I was, does not understand how it's all going to fit together. And man, a really clever makeup person speaking up early is like what they need in those production meetings, but they're often not brought into those meetings. Mm. They're considered just a service provider.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We need this. Service. Deliver us this.
Yeah. Deliver us this. And that's such a lot. Okay. So let's switch channels now. In your brain, it's your ideal writing day.
Oh.
You're not on set. You're not baking silicone molds at home. You're not a burnt vampire today. You're just a writer. You're Emma the writer. What's that like?
Ooh, that would probably be getting up early, which I have in my ideal head. I'm somebody who gets up early, but it rarely happens. So I feel so productive when I get up early. So I'd probably be getting up early, getting coffee, sitting down at my desk and writing for a few hours and listening to music. And
what kind of music?
I have a really weird music process where I generally pick one song that's my like now we're writing song. So I start with that song, and it's usually something just dumb. Like one time it was some 3 Days Grace song that was really loud and like obnoxious, and you wouldn't think of it as writing music. And then I normally just let my music shuffle. Or if I'm having a really hard time concentrating, I'll just look up like music to study to on Spotify. So I'm not super loyal to yeah, just generic sound. Or I do also like, Greg, I've heard you talk about how you like to write in like areas like coffee shops and stuff where there's places
white
stuff
noise
going on.
Give me yes. white noise every time. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I actually sometimes I'll put on a TV show just like in the other room or like far away on quiet, just so that there's something happening that I can have going on, but like tune out. Well, it can't be too engaging though, or else I'll get distracted and watch that. But
that's interesting that you're putting on the show, but not in the same room where you're writing. You just want the noise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Noise.
Yeah, cool. Exactly. And then yeah, writing.
Why do we feel silence so much? I'm just thinking.
So I think we're social creatures and we're most comfortable when we're around other humans, or we can trick ourselves to thinking there's other humans close by.
You're right. Because like when I'm writing, I'm kind of in antisocial mode, but I like to go to a social place and collect bits from around me. It's, yeah, I don't know. Okay, so you're writing, you got your cued music that kind of like tells your brain, all right, now's the time, this is what we're doing. Do you work from an outline? Are you a plotter? Are you a pantser?
I am a plotter. And sometimes I am too much of a plotter where my plotting gets in the way of my writing, where I'm like, oh yeah, I'll just work on my outline. That's the same as writing, which is a useful step, but is not quite the same thing as writing. So I will plan for forever and not actually write if I let myself. So I have to draw it back at a certain point and just actually start writing as opposed to planning. So I'm trying to scale back my planning amounts.
We've been talking about how that is the scaffolding around the house that you are building. The book is, the writing is the house in the middle, and the scaffolding is all the other things that go along with it. You can get really distracted by building the scaffolding and then rebuilding the scaffolding instead of concentrating on the house in the middle. That's the real project.
Yes, exactly. And because I write primarily fantasy, there's a lot of scaffolding that you can get lost in, like, oh, let me tweak this one detail of the magic system that nobody's ever going to know because it's not actually going to make it in the book, but it's really important that I figure it out right now.
I've been there. And then you add a notation about how 700 years ago some school of wizardry adapted this to become this other thing, and then they moved away and founded a city. You know, it's
exactly
more outline when you're plotting. I sometimes plot, I sometimes pants. I prefer kind of a mixture of the two, but when you're plotting, the plot is to a novel what a script is to a film in some regards. You need it to know what you're doing, but it isn't the work.
Yeah.
The work, the film is the work, the novel is the work. You have to have done some work, some pre-work to do it. You do credit the screenwriter, but let's face it, without all the crew and the director, it would still just be there on the page, unrealized.
Yes, yeah, that's a very good analogy for it, absolutely.
Many more screenplays sitting out there than finished movies.
Yeah, there's more outlines than books, right?
Yep,
more
outlines than
books. Okay, so you are writing this work, you are producing this work, are you setting the deadline yourself? Are you working with a publisher? Are you at a point in your career where you have an agent involved, or are you right now seeking that kind of stuff? Like, where are you in that landscape? Which is, the mileage varies for everybody.
Yeah, I'm very early in that. So haven't been published, haven't gotten anything to a stage where I'm happy enough with it to actually try and pitch it. So I am, working on trying to finish something and then edit it so that I could potentially publish it. So deadlines, I generally set for myself or try to. They kind of went out the window a little bit with the event. I went through that whole cycle of, I have all this free time, why am I not using it to write? Oh, it's because I'm experiencing this intensely traumatic worldwide event, so maybe I should give myself some slack and not be so concerned that I'm not writing, but trying to get a little bit back on the horse again now, hopefully. So I have a goal for 2021. I've just started outlining a new project that I want to work on, or a new novel that I'm excited about that I think will go well. But it's interesting. I'm very much more an editor at heart than a writer. I talk to my writing friends who are always talking about how they love writing the first draft, and it's the best part is getting the words out, and then how editing is such a slog. And I'm the complete opposite. I hate drafting. I would way rather have a piece that I can edit and make nice. So the getting the words onto the page for the first draft is the really tough part for me. And then once I have it and I get to edit it, then I'm happy.
One does not simply walk into Mordor.
Do you feel like you have an unfair advantage there? Like you can edit your own stuff, or would you rather have an outside editor come in? So they don't have that, like a different perspective to be doing the editing.
I think I would always want to get an outside editor to look at it at some point, but I do think that it really helps that I know how to edit my own work, as an editor and working at a publishing house there, or house might be too grand, at a publishing company. One big problem is that people don't know how to edit their own work. So they send things that are first drafts or are multiple drafts, but don't know what they're looking for, what they're editing. And that, of course, makes it a lot harder to get to a polished, publishable state, which makes it really tough to be a project that a publisher wants to take on, because the more effort, the more hours, the more money you're spending editing it, the less profit there's going to be from it ultimately. So I think being able to edit my own work, and for writers to be able to edit their own work, you don't need to do it to the level of a professional editor, but having some basic self-editing skills, or even intermediate self-editing skills, I think can only be helpful, really.
Tell us what those are.
Oh, man. I'd say if you read one or two books on self-editing, you will be well-prepared. Things, just basic, some of the basic things that I look for is things like word repetition, so not using the same word every sentence, especially if it's a really standout word, like if it's something like proboscis, if you're using the word proboscis every second paragraph, that
and
really
now I feel
noticeable.
Like you guys are just making fun of me.
Stuff like that, things like basic grammar stuff, like if you read, you know, every writer should have a copy of Elements
Strunk
of White. Style.
Elements,
yes, yeah,
style.
That's it.
I was writing down, bring up Strunk and White.
Yes.
Yeah, and for those who've never heard of it or don't know, Strunk and White, Elements of Style, is a very little book. There are bigger versions where people have padded it out with all kinds of bullshit, pardon my language, but find the littlest version that you can find, which is the original version. And it is basically a guidepost for what to carve out of your writing that gets in the way of what you mean.
Yep.
And you can be ruthless. Once you're done reading Strunk and White, you're sure that every sentence you read is garbage, no matter who wrote it. And then you internalize it a little bit until you're like, okay, omit needless words. Yes. No adverbs. Okay. Watch the split infinitives. I got it. Right. You're like, this kind of stuff starts to, but people take what they want out of a style guide like that. You don't have to buy Strunk and White and think, I have to learn it and do everything in here. It's called Elements, plural, of Style. And style is what you're going to bring of yourself to the work.
Yes. Right? Yeah. You don't have to memorize the whole thing and apply it mechanically, but it is good to know some of what those rules are. And like you said, the biggest thing that I think would help people learn how to edit their stuff is that ability to be ruthless and cut stuff out. The biggest part of editing is just cutting stuff out that maybe, yeah, like it may be great. This may be a beautiful paragraph and you may have some great imagery, but if it does nothing for the plot or the character development or anything to do with your story, it's gotta go. And that's why I think it's really hard for people to edit their own work as opposed to somebody else editing it, because if I write it, I'm going to be attached to it and I don't want to kill it, but somebody else can come in and kill it and they're fine with that.
I would do this exercise when I was teaching high school in editing, where I would have the kids all bring in their favorite book, a page of their favorite book. They wouldn't know what the assignment was coming up. And I'd say, okay, now you're going to edit it and make it better. So it's already a published work. It's already often very famous or very, you know, lauded. And I was like, nope. I, as the publisher here now, I'm the CEO. I'm telling you, this is garbage. Make it better. Follow the Elements of Style and improve it according to the Elements of Style. And it took, you know, like when you're in grade 12, the idea that you're going to cut up some great work of literature to make it better according to someone else's style guide seems crazy. But because taste changes, mm-hmm. right? And depending on when the book is written, it can become very easy to adjust even something that's only a few years old to a more modern voice following the elements of style, which was written, what, like 150 years ago, right? So it's an incredibly powerful tool, which is why I love having an editor, because I get very attached to, the eloquence of my prose. And so someone else being like, no, that's dumb. Just cut it out. It's necessary.
Yeah. I've learned that if I have to spend too long on a sentence or a paragraph in my work, like if I'm spending an hour on one paragraph, it's probably because it's not supposed to be there and I'm trying too hard to get it to work. Like at a certain point, you just got to, it's not working, take it out. It's gotta go. Put it in a different document, save it. You can use that, beautiful sunset description for a different work, but maybe not this one. Not everything belongs in a particular work.
I think that's hard. That makes it so much easier when you don't have just the one project, when you have multiple projects either planned out or on the go, it's so much easier to cut things out because you can save them for later. This doesn't work for this project, but it doesn't have to die here. It can be put on ice and used in another project. And that's helped me so much with my work. I don't have to be as precious with my ideas because I know that if it's good, I'll be able to use it later. And I think that's really hard with people who are only writing the first book or only want to do the one book. That's why it's so hard to cut out those paragraphs and that description of the sunset, because they don't know if they'll write another book.
Early on in my career, I started going to some literary festivals, and this was like also early in the development of like the affordable laptop or like word processing. Like people are bringing things into classrooms, like it's common now, but this was new at the time. And I remember overhearing, and I to this day don't know who it was that said it, because I was just like in a room full of people, mingling and doing their stuff. And they said, when I'm editing, what I do is I open another file and I title it my next book. And whatever I'm cutting out of my current draft, I trick myself into saying, I'm not obliterating it. I'm putting it into my next book. And so they just like take a whole character out, or they take a whole passage out, the end of the conversation was like, well, do you ever use that to draft your next book? And they're like, oh, almost never.
Yeah.
But I need to trick myself.
Yeah.
Make that easier.
That it's not gone forever, because I worked hard to bring that out of my spirit,
Yeah. No, that's a great trick. Really, mostly editing is just tricking your brain into doing what you want it to do.
Yeah. Producing magic. Okay. So let's switch channels again. Your role in a publishing capacity, how does Mythos and Ink arrive, become what it is? What is it going to be? Yeah. How does it start? How did you convince yourself that publishing, that's a great idea?
So Mythos and Ink started, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. It was originally, so our two founders, Kyle and Allison, originally worked on an online magazine called Infinity Plus One. And they did that for a couple of years. And when it was time for that to come to an end, they decided to switch into publishing because they really wanted to do that as their next project, next thing, next venture. They did that for, I think, a year or two on their own, and then needed to get a little bit bigger, bring some more people on. And that's when I joined. Originally, I was actually doing publicity, but I hated publicity and did not want to do it. So I got to switch to doing editing instead, which I enjoy much more. I really admire people who work in like marketing and advertising and publicity because it's very cool, but I can't do it. So I love seeing people who can do stuff that I can't doing it, but I much prefer editing. And then we expanded a little bit more again and brought on Christiana, who is working in our marketing department as of this year. So we love having them. They're great. And yeah, so it's been, I think I've been working for Mythos for about 4 years now. Wow, that's crazy. Two of them during a pandemic, which is not the ideal time to be doing anything business related, but that's what it is. And we just really wanted to make a publishing space that was ethical. Not that there are not other ethical publishers, but there's a lot of, anybody who works in creative or writing fields knows that there's a lot of predatory publishers out there. And that's not even aside from, straight up scams like vanity presses, but there's a lot of, even in legitimate publishing companies, there's a lot of, it's to make money. And so your authors are cash cows that you want to squeeze every last drop out of. as opposed to people that you want to treat like people. And we wanted to create a publishing space that valued creativity and telling stories and mentorship and authors and creatives for themselves and for their work. And if it makes money, awesome, so much the better. We want to make our authors money. We want to make ourselves money, but we also want to do it in a way that is good and that ultimately tells stories, because that's what we're super passionate about.
Gentlemen, we do not stop till nightfall.
What about breakfast?
We've already had it.
We've had one, yes. What about second breakfast?
In Canada, much of our publishing industry in Canada is grant supported. So many smaller publishers can receive grants to support the arts community and the writing community. Now that sounds utopian, but because a person who is excellent at paperwork and accounting can apply for these grants, they can quickly realize that getting lots of authors through the door is more grant money for them to pay themselves as the fixed asset of the company, right? While the author's book itself, they're not interested in promoting it. They don't care if that book makes money. They've published it, they've done their job, they've put the least number of copies they can into the marketplace. They move on to the next author, apply for the next grant related to that, and get paid yet again. So mm-hmm. this is becoming, it's been exposed. The the bones are now bare.
So there's no incentive for them to do a good job selling the book, getting it out there.
Yeah, it would actually take time away from the easy job of making money signing up new authors.
Yeah.
Right? I won't mention companies that have done this in the past. Cheesy. but allegedly. Sorry, that was another sneeze. Allegedly. but this kind of stuff does happen, and it can lead to a lot of heartbreak and hurt feelings mm-hmm. and lost sales. So you guys weren't interested in doing that as your business model?
No. No, we were not.
I hear it's lucrative. I hear it can be lucrative.
Yes. Yeah. So maybe we should have done it that way. We could have made some more money, but...
What are some of the challenges that the event has brought to a fledgling publisher that is just getting off the ground, and then a big gust of wind to knock them off?
Yeah, so book launches was definitely one. We had some digital launches, which went really well, I think, for the most part, but was definitely a switch in gears, and I think can be tougher to get people out to, especially in, you know, a time when you're going to work by Zoom and you're meeting your family on Zoom, and it's like, oh, I don't want to do another Zoom thing. So that was a little tough. Luckily for us, a lot of our platform and distribution and marketing was already online. So that was helpful, and that didn't change too much. One of the biggest things was probably just individual burnouts. Like, working at a small company with not a lot of people is already stressful, and it's a lot of work. And then add to it, compounded, that you're now dealing with isolation and, you know, all of the stuff that happens in a pandemic, being a team of four with everybody having varying situations and difficulties outside of publishing was probably just the biggest thing of what made it difficult to operate during 2020 and 2021.
And full disclosure for the listener, Rust and Water, our sort of mass market soft cover edition, we released through Mythos and Ink.
There we go.
And around that, we released through Mythos and Ink because to us, when you know, this again is pre-event, essentially said, like, can we take a book that has a following, has a certain thing that you are already doing, and we'll do it in another space. Mm-hmm. We're developing different avenues. We consider that to be kind of a sort of a no-brainer. Why would you say no? kind of where it's at. What's that been like for you guys to approach people and then have to be like, oh, by the way, the world shut down, the economy is tanking, and nobody was working, and right, all the ways that we had, they don't exist now.
Yeah, that was probably the toughest thing, was wanting to make sure that we were still doing right by our authors, because we didn't want to just churn out whatever and not market it and not support that. So there was definitely a constant feeling of, okay, well, how do we make sure that we're still doing what we said? How do we make sure that we're still supporting the creatives who have trusted us with their work to get it out there. So that was, yeah, that was kind of tough to balance. And like, we did the best that we could, and I think we did a reasonably good job, I hope. But yeah, it's hard when there's external things that you're working with and trying to navigate that don't just impact you, but impact other people as well. That's the hard thing, is when, yeah, when stuff impacts people that you like and that you care about and impacts their work, and you don't want it to negatively affect anybody else. And yeah, still figuring that out. Still,
don't,
I mean, we're still 2 years.
You're putting on makeup, but don't touch my eyes.
Right? Yeah, I mean, 2 years into the pandemic, we're still, you know, trying to figure out what that looks like, because everything is shifting all the time. And I think it will be for a while still, until things go back to some version of normal. Yeah. But yeah.
Or maybe we'll just look at the past as being strange, because how it is now.
I really,
those bizarre former times.
Yeah, I miss book launches a lot.
We have like 3 books between us that we haven't been able to book launch. And that was always like, it's the party. It's the finish line party that you get to have for this accomplishment.
And you get to really connect with your audience and the people who show up more than when you're online and you see the names and you see the chat. But it's not the same thing as being in front of people and getting to talk to them and getting to interact and that sort of thing. So I'm really looking forward to in-person book launches again. I think that'll be really nice to be able to do.
Yeah, I think so too. So switching channels yet again, you guys, or you specifically, as an editor, as a creative person, as a writer, as someone who understands sort of behind the curtains of how books get made, shipped, produced, how does that affect your writing output when you come back around to that version of yourself?
Hmm.
You find yourself, you know, that you know too much?
A little bit. I know how little money there is to go around in making books. So, and because yes, for every New York Times bestseller, there are 1,000 books that, you know, sell 100 copies or don't make it to print. So that can be a little tough sometimes, thinking, okay, well, I write this book, and then what happens to it? Do I find a publisher that wants to publish it? Do I find a good publisher that wants to publish it? Does it make any money? Do I get, you know, $10 for this book that I spent a year writing? So that can be a little tough to always have in kind of the back of my head. But on the other hand, I also get to see and experience the excitement of getting your book published, even if it doesn't make a ton of money. We have a couple of first-time authors at Mythos, and getting to see them when they first hold their published book in like print is the best thing ever. And I think that there's a value, and there is a reward to that that is worthwhile, even if you're not getting paid a whole bunch. So that's kind of the two things that I think are most impactful from, you know, having the publishing side of it and then doing the writing side. So I really try not to write with the expectation of making any sort of money, because I think that the chances are very slim. And if it happens, that would be great. But more so, if anybody wanted to read what I wrote, that would be the, like, that's the thing that I want. Is if like one person's like, oh, I really liked reading your book, there you go, cool, that's what I want, that would be great.
Yeah, the purpose of writing is to be read, in a sense. It completes the circuit. I shouldn't say the purpose of writing. I believe the purpose of writing is self-archaeology.
Mm.
Once you have it, you can decide what to do with it, right? Some of it is for me, it's a secret, and some of it, oh, well, someone else might like this. Sure, I'll share. What is your relationship with your own submission process, knowing that a person like you is on the other side of that submission? Because you're receiving submissions and sending out subs too. So how
does it work? It's always tough to reject a submission. You never really enjoy doing it.
Come on.
Sometimes there's some.
I can see in your face. Your listener, you can't see. I saw that she's like, I'm going to lie and say that. I could see through that.
Tell me, friend, when did Saruman the Wise abandon reason for madness?
It's really difficult to be a jerk in a submission, but sometimes people still manage to do it. And then you're like, okay, I don't feel so bad about rejecting you because this is almost a foolproof process, but you manage to be a jerk. So other than that, though, you generally don't like rejecting people, especially because it's really tough to do a rejection that actually gives meaningful feedback because the amount of time that it would take. And also then you open yourself up to people sending you back angry emails or, you know, all of that kind of emotional labor that goes along with it as well. It's just not possible to respond to every submission with a, hey, here's what you could do to improve it for next time, which as an editor, you want to do. That's what you want to be doing is, okay, here are these things that didn't work. If you fix them, it could work, but you can't do that for a minute. So that's the really tough thing.
Entire day. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be a full-time job just responding to submissions. So that's, I think the toughest thing is that I would love to be able to give feedback to everybody that queries, but unfortunately you can't. And you just hope that the rejection doesn't crush them to the point where they don't do it again, but that's kind of out of our hands, right? Like that's part of the unfortunate reality that you have to build some resilience being in a creative field because rejection is just kind of part of it. Yeah.
Do you listen to the podcast, The Shit They Don't Tell You About Writing?
No, but I've heard of it. It is on my list.
It's a great podcast. And what they do is they'll actually go through queries that they've received and talk about what's working and what's not and give feedback to that person. They usually have that person on the podcast.
Oh.
They tell what's working about the query, what's not, and blah, blah, blah.
So they can have that complete disappointment recorded for all time and shared with strangers.
It's a really good podcast, but I've been listening to it because I've only done a couple queries. I've probably done 10 to 15, but I'd like to do more in the future. So I've been collecting do's and don'ts about queries, like getting your book, submitting your book for agents and publishers. And I was hoping for the listeners who are thinking about submitting their very first manuscripts, their very first graphic novels, what are some like do's and don'ts or some beginner tips that you could give, like the really glaring, obvious things that you like to see and that you don't like to see?
The first obvious thing is follow the format of the submission that is requested on the website or wherever you're looking at this publisher. Don't send in a Word document if the request is for it to be in the body of an email. Don't send links to things if that's not requested. If you can find the name of the editor or the submissions person, use their name. Don't just use Dear Editor. Definitely don't be spelling their name incorrectly or use the wrong name. Those things are all kind of basics because if you get a submission that's in the wrong format, that's probably not, you're not even going to look at it most of the time. Like that's just, it's going straight into the trash because unfortunately there's reasons why you request submissions in certain formats.
Yeah, those are destination oblivion ones.
Yeah. So that's a big one. Another one is one thing that's hard is almost universally prologues are a bad idea, especially for queries, because if you're only submitting the first chapter or 10 pages, a prologue is not what you want to be submitting because it doesn't really get into the story. And 9 times out of 10, your prologue is going to get cut out anyway, because 9 times out of 10 prologues just don't do very much for your story. That couldn't just be in a chapter one. There are exceptions to that, but for the most part, cut out your prologue.
You're going to like that podcast. They famously hate prologues and they talk about how they hate prologues. Pretty much every episode. So
I definitely agree with that. Yeah, don't do a prologue.
No, hold on a second before we leave past it, I agree with you.
I defend the prologue.
No, I'm not going to defend the prologue because I can understand, I think, intrinsically why you wouldn't want a prologue, but I think a person who has written a book with a prologue doesn't understand that. Let's take a minute and break that apart. If you've written your fantasy epic or your noir dystopian troll book, whatever it is, the prologue feels to an author that's done that like a way to introduce people to the entire concept. It almost feels like a cover letter to the world. It's the trailer for the mysteries within. Why can't I do that? I'll take the argument. I don't prologue, but I will take the position of the person who wants a prologue. Why can't I?
Usually what a prologue ends up being is it is world building or backstory that you couldn't fit into your story, but you wanted to be included.
Especially so for that lore, right?
Yes, exactly. It's a, here's this war that happened 700 years ago that you're not going to know about unless I show you. So it's one of those things like we were talking about earlier that is a darling. It's a piece that you love, but it just shouldn't be there because it's not. Usually if that information is relevant, it's much more effective to reveal that throughout your story than it is to put it in an info dump at the beginning.
So I notice in a lot of YA fantasy, the first page or two, usually just the first page, is like some poem or prophecy. Is that the editor convincing the author, like, okay, scrap effing prologue, and if you gotta put some reference to the ancient god of 7,000 years ago, at least write it as a little poem. People will skip it or not understand it, but you got your wish and I need mine.
Is that it definitely could be. I wouldn't put it past that to be an editorial, negotiating tactic of, we'll slip it in, but just don't give me 30 pages.
I just want to put it on a prologue. No, you can do three verses, but they can't rhyme.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So you're going through your submissions pile, the slush pile. You are... do you receive ever physical?
No.
It's all digital.
All digital. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question about when I'm sending out graphic novels, I'm running into a bit of a, I don't know what to do with a lot of editors and a lot of agents. They only want text-based submissions.
If they're open to graphic novel queries, online systems will only accept a text-based submission.
Yes.
What should I be doing when I have a whole bunch of artwork that is really the strongest part of that project, but they seem to not have a way to accept any of that? What should I be doing in that situation?
We actually had a similar problem where, our query system or our submission system was only set up for text, even though we were accepting graphic novels. And I believe, I don't remember whether the person just submitted a query just with text or if they sent us an email. But in either case, they said, hey, I've got a graphic novel. This is it. How do I send you artwork? At which point we then said, okay, well, you can email us this.
Okay.
So I would do that. Like if the publisher has an info email address or something like that, where you can just shoot them an email and say, hey, this is the situation. I want to send you this. How can I do that? I don't think that would be ever an annoyance or a, red flag for a publisher to have someone ask that, because obviously you need to show them what this graphic novel is if they're going to be publishing it.
And better to do it that way than just firing them a PDF when they haven't at least let you in the door.
Yes. Yeah. I would definitely start it off with a question or a discussion rather than I'm assuming this is how I should do it. Better to ask, I think, than to just, send off a document, because nobody wants to open a strange document anyway. Like that's just asking for your computer to be filled with viruses. So
yeah, so awesome. True.
Good to hear. Thank
and,
you.
because often it will say like, no, like you already mentioned, don't send links, don't send whatever. So if you just ask nicely, it's basically what you're saying.
The hurdle is like, send the first 10 pages of the manuscript, but I have a silent graphic novel. The first 10 written pages of that graphic novel do not exist. It is not a thing because it's silent. And I don't know if I now have to reverse engineer my artwork into describing what happened to the first 10 pages, or if I can just reach out and ask, can I send you some pictures?
Yeah, I think the second one would definitely be better. Reading, I feel like the only thing worse than reading a screenplay would be reading a description of what's in a graphic novel.
Yes, panel one.
Yeah.
Nobody tosses a dwarf.
In the comic space, if you have art, send art. That is, editors want to see the art. They'll demand to see the art. They will often ask, I shouldn't say often, more increasingly now, they'll say, if you have a link to an online portfolio, include that, right? If you have a link to your social media, include that. In the comic book world, where self-publishing is not quite so such a dirty word as in trade publication, if you made some stuff and you want to send it, those editors, they live and die by those art submissions. And that's the space we spend most of our time in. And so as we are sort of evolving into some new arenas, the archaic architecture of those arenas, even though they're asking us, send us your graphic novel pitches, or I have some, gonna have some stuff out on sub this year. I was like, well, how do we even send?
I want graphic novels, but only send me text.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? How does this work?
Wait, right? What does that mean? Yeah.
It's like, we're accepting submissions for symphonies. Please send a WAV file where you've hummed a few bars. Right?
That'll give you a good idea.
Right? It's not quite the same. What do you think? You've been in the trenches now on a couple of different sides of it. What do you think the future holds for print on demand, for books to your door, for in-person launches, for, we want to hold you to it.
Yeah, predict the future for us,
please. Predict the future.
Perfect. Let me just grab my crystal ball that I've stashed here.
Well, you literally have a Christmas star up behind you.
Maybe
right?
it'll tell me. Yeah. I wish it would have predicted the pandemic. That would have been helpful to know in advance. I think print on demand is becoming bigger, for better or for worse. There's definitely pros and cons. And Mythos and Inc's business models, we do a print on demand. It's good for small publishers because you don't have the overhead of having to pay thousands of dollars for a print run or to store it or to do all that kind of stuff. And then of course the con, or the one of the big cons, is that bookstores and distributors won't work with print on demand. Then you're doing all of your own advertising and your own footwork. So it's more labor, but less money intensive. But I think print on demand is going to be good for those reasons. It's good for, self-publishing. It gives people, because not every author has $5,000 to drop on a print run, but if you can upload your book to Amazon and have it just print when people order it, that's a lot more feasible.
Right. And then print it once they earned $5,000 off the work.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
We were just talking about a printer and talking about that, the problem that we see sometimes with first time authors or first time graphic novels, where they are really excited about the project and they print far too many books before they're quite ready to move that quantity of books. So print on demand is great for people who are just getting into the industry because they don't have to spend, like you said, $5,000 to $20,000 to get thousands of books that they don't know how to move yet.
Yeah. Yeah. It is really good for that, which is awesome, but can also be, I think, really discouraging for people who do, self-publish or take that route, because if your book doesn't sell, then that can be whether because maybe you did it too soon or you didn't know how to market it, because of course marketing is a whole different skill than writing. Just because you're a writer doesn't mean that you know how to market your book. So that can be really devastating for fledgling authors, I think, as well. So again, you got to develop that tough skin, which is really hard. But I think print on demand is going to be increasing, and hopefully you get more venues for it. Right now there's only a couple, like Amazon is the big one, and Amazon's kind of evil, so it'd be nice to have some options that were perhaps a little bit less evil for people to print through. Would be nice. I don't think that physical books are going away. Everybody had the ebook is going to take over and nobody's going to buy physical books anymore kind of panic, but that I don't think physical books are ever really going away. Ebooks are great, they're nice, but they're not a replacement.
Can I make an observation that it is possible that Amazon is not in fact evil, that Amazon is a projection of our individual selfishness? That it exists and is as wealthy as it is because we want it as we want it, and we want it yesterday.
Yeah.
And if we didn't, Amazon wouldn't have any power.
That is true. Yeah. I would still maybe argue that that is perhaps evil, but it's just a manifestation of everybody's evil as opposed to
all in one place. We're drafting the first draft of a novel right now.
The eldritch horror that is Amazon being created by
page
us.
Page one. Prologue,
yeah. 500 years ago. The Amazon rainforest.
Right. Oh my goodness. Okay. All right. So I didn't mean to just derail you. You were onto some great points about the future.
Yes, the future. Yeah, it's so hard to predict, because it is so wobbly right now as to what things look like. I think we will have online or in-person book launches again. I think that's a thing that's really been missing. And I think that that is a thing that, while can be substituted for virtually, isn't really the same. So I think we will be seeing that.
Do you think there's going to be like a backup of pressure of all these people who want to, like, that weren't able to launch books? So as soon as we're allowed to again, everybody's going to be launching their back catalog that they didn't get a chance to. Because I know that's what we want to do.
Yeah.
Right? We want to launch the book that came out in 2020 next year.
A whole bunch of premature book promotion will occur.
Oh, like a vow renewal, but for your book relaunch. Yeah, no, I could definitely see people doing that, especially because we have been in a environment of so little in-person celebration. I think people really just want to feel good about stuff and celebrate stuff. So I think that I could definitely see us having kind of a run on book launches. And then maybe there comes book launch fatigue, where then there's not any book launches again for a while.
You know, like, if I consider who my peer group is, when all the book launches start up again, I'm going to have a full social calendar. I'm going to have a daily book launch, two a day for months.
Yeah.
It's untenable, right? It's not going to be possible. Maybe bookstores should just have a book launch day.
Oh.
Where every book is launched in a huge celebration.
Oh my god, I'd go to that.
Yeah,
like a Scholastic book fair, but yeah, just for like
orgy of new books. Yeah. Just, you know, pages everywhere. And
oh, that sounds great. Yeah, McNally Robinson should definitely do that.
You have like 10 minutes, and then the buzzer goes, and the next person goes up and does their talk. And
like,
then, yeah,
like
speed dating.
Yeah, maybe.
For book launches.
I think we're on to something, honestly.
There we go. Yeah.
We need to pitch this. I think McNally would be down.
Yeah, we're going
to
pitch this idea. Mythos and Inc. can help. They can help co-sponsor. What about a world, let's just be in the future for a minute. What about a world where bookstores, because I love the brick and mortar bookstore, but print on demand makes it so much less of a risk. If we got, and we've had 2 years where people have had to pre-order things. It used to be no one would pre-order stuff. So you had to pile up the ziggurats of books. Now, have we perhaps created enough training that people are in the habit of pre-ordering a book that you could say the book launch of your book is on this date, pre-order your copies, they'll all be waiting for you at the launch, the publisher, and like, it's all very transparent. The publisher is doing it this way because, you know, the event got us all. So help support this author by pre-ordering your book. They're already used to it. They've already have all of those habits and those ways to buy it. And then they just show up and take the copies that they've already paid
for. Like, you could do a Kickstarter or Indiegogo where any local purchases,
you do it at a launch.
You're picking it up at the launch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be, I think that there is something to that of, yeah, we're so used to ordering things online or doing pre-orders now. And pre-orders are incredibly helpful for authors because it, you know, tells their publishers that people want to buy this book, and then the publisher will print more copies of that book. So yeah, it's like, if there is an author that you like or think you might like, and they have books for pre-order, that is the number one helpful thing you can do, is to pre-order their book. And yeah, incorporating that into actual launches could be very cool, and would work with like a print on demand model as well. So I think that there is definitely some fun to be had with that.
Like, I'm thinking out loud, like, you know, we do these short run limited edition art prints stuff all as another part of our business and our art practice, ensuring that every person who pre-orders a book gets this other thing. Right, so there's an added incentive. Could be a great way. Justin has got, he has the face. Yeah. He's like, we're gonna. So tune in next year.
Yeah, the tough thing with pre-ordering for books is that it's hard to show people what's going to be in the book. Like with a movie trailer, you can, you know, show snippets of a movie, and you kind of know what you're going to get, and it builds some interest.
With this summer.
Yeah.
Right? Some pages with text will be with you while you sit on the deck.
And I know people do book trailers, but they I don't recommend really doing a book trailer. There's some other kind of maybe fun stuff you can do around that, but just a full-on kind of enactment of what happens in your book doesn't really work very well. And the tough thing is too, is that for the most part, books are kind of being done right, like they're being made still right up until they're published. Usually it's not like you finish a book and then you sit on it for a year and then you publish it. It's like, okay, it's going to layout, it's getting the cover design, it's getting proofread, okay, a month from now it's launching. So you don't really have that time where you have a finished product where you could show snippets of it or do that sort of thing.
Yeah, and even if you have a big lead up in the trade market, you've had to turn in your finished manuscript. It might be 2 years before it finally makes press, but you don't get to do tweaks. It's in production now.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And that makes it difficult to sort of market or convince people to do a pre-order unless it's a big author who's already well known, you know, like Brandon Sanderson stuff always gets pre-ordered because you know what it's going to be. So it's tough to convince people to pre-order. And I think that there's some space to grow in that for sure, is kind of figuring out the best ways to market that.
It's hard, like I'm thinking in the like graphic novels and especially like on Kickstarter, you have to have enough done of the book that people can envision that end product. But it's hard for some people to convince, like you have to have 80% of the book done before you're going to make a dime, right? Like you have to put in months of
thousands
work
of
before
hours.
You can hope for a pre-order. You can't just jump in there. Yeah, it's tough.
Well, times. Emma, thank you for sharing your multifaceted experiences and expertise with us.
We have been all over on this podcast.
Yeah,
man.
Layer makeup. And
I love it. We peeled predicting. Back the surface. That's right. I hope personally that this is a prologue to future episodes where you can visit and share some of your creative practice as a writer and as a makeup artist and as an editor and publisher. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I will come back anytime. I'll just stake out your guys' office and wait in the hallway for when you need a guest next time.
That was a vampire pun, right? This has
the circle back. Had to get full circle.
Circle back. This has been Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. This is Gregory Kamichuk encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.